Thank you for listening to Two Bulls in a China Shop. If you enjoyed this conversation, please let us know by rating and subscribing on your platform of choice. And if you want more, you can check us out at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number two. You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face. Oh, well, hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the China Shop. We are back here with another exciting guest interview. Dan is taking the day off. He's still in the process of moving to Vegas. But joining me today, we have got a shop favorite, Dr. Hans, the investing tutor. Dr. Hans, how are you doing?
Oh, Kyle, doing very, very well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been, we've been trying to get you on for, I think most of the year, actually. Just seems like you've been a busy guy lately.
Yes, it's been quite the year from launching a new NFT project to, you know, focusing on selling it out and now transitioning, you know, back to the investing tutor, you know, because now it's like you're managing two different companies. And not to mention, we've also been blessed with a little one. She's 6 months now, Paisley. And so two companies plus, you know, two kids, it's quite the ordeal.
How old was the older one?
He's 2.5, Princeton.
Oh, that is the age where they get tough too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the last time we spoke was actually during the Festivus episode, and you were telling us that you had some exciting stuff going on with NFTs, but we never got a chance to follow up. So maybe you want to speak a little bit about the project that you just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was looking at the NFT space when it became, you know, huge in 2021. And the thing that stood out to me was there was so much like hype around kind of just the digital art pieces. And I felt like individuals were missing the utility, meaning if I buy this thing, what is it going to offer me, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important is because someone who isn't really big into crypto or someone who doesn't kind of collect art, that individual would want to know that, I'm buying this thing and I'm getting XYZ. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at this space and I was like, the reason this is also important is because if we don't have really great utility associated with NFTs, what's going to happen is that we're not going to be able to onboard a diverse group of individuals into the NFT space. So I went ahead and thought of this idea, okay, what would be an exciting thing that individuals would love, you know, as it relates to, you know, being able to experience different cultures. That was the idea that came to me because...
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting. Yeah.
Because looking back, and I'm digressing a bit, looking back when tech, like late 90s, when tech was booming, you notice that it, you know, you didn't have a ton of diversity in tech back then. So this time around with, you know, NFTs, you know, booming, I was like, well, what if we could, you know, onboard so many different cultures across the globe into this space? So that's when the idea of Royals came in. So the idea is this: each Royals collection will showcase a particular culture, right, through the artwork.
Okay.
Specifically, we're going to focus on showcasing this culture through fashion. Right.
Okay.
Something that most individuals just are used to. So it's not like they need to, you know, have a huge art sense to be able to, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's a little more accessible.
Exactly. So showcase different cultures through fashion and allow the NFT to serve as an invitation to be able to visit the country or the culture being showcased, right? So
it's like a digital trip almost?
Exactly. So the first country slash culture that we're showcasing with this first initial collection that we dropped in March of this year is Ghana, where I was born and raised. And we are, showcasing Ghanaian culture and also inviting all NFT holders. And we minted 3,000 NFTs.
Okay.
We're inviting the NFT holders to Ghana this December and for a full week in Ghana from December 27th all the way through January 2nd. We've curated different experiences and events in Ghana for NFT holders. And one of the largest during, this week that we've put together is the Royal Gala. So obviously the NFT is the Royals,
mm-hmm.
and we're hosting a Royal Gala in Ghana. And the idea is it's pretty much a 7-hour event where individuals who come in are able to fully be immersed in the country's culture, from our Broadway plays to our music to our artists, celebrities, to our food, dancing, drumming.
Yeah.
And we're connecting the NFT holders to local designers who will make different clothes for them so they can actually wear it to the gala.
Oh, that's neat.
The simplest way I like to kind of define it is that it's like Met Gala infused with African culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the quick kind of description of the NFT, but I can go into, even more utility. Like, we provide financial and personal development education as part of one of the NFTs. Also, we provide personalized travel advisory services so that when an individual is traveling, they don't feel like, oh, what do I need to do? Where do I get my visa?
Right.
Who do I call if I have any kind of questions on the trip? We curate and provide a concierge service for all NFT holders. So they don't even need to think about, what do I do?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was thinking that I was trying to visualize that in my head of like an itinerary that's actually an NFT.
Yes.
Where I'm trying to look on my phone to see like, okay, so this token that I have is now what's holding all the information for my travel plans. Is that what you're saying, or is that something, am I off base?
That is, it's a part of it, right? Because we are creating an itinerary of experiences you can have.
Mm-hmm.
The NFT is the main invitation. Without the NFT, you cannot be considered a royal, right?
Gotcha.
And when you have the NFT, now you're a royal. So we are laying out kind of the red carpet.
Right.
And treating you as royalty when you land in whatever country that we host this experience.
Okay, so the NFT is more like your ticket.
Exactly.
In this case.
Exactly. It's the ticket to the experience.
So an NFT, like the way I'm used to seeing them, is like as a digital artwork, right?
Exactly.
So is that what this is too? Like, do they get something that's like a digital picture of something to do with Ghana that like gives them like a memory, kind of keepsake almost?
Absolutely. Remember we talked about it? The mm-hmm. traditional attire or outfit, the clothing.
Right, right.
Fashion. So each NFT has a different look. You can see guys in, traditional suits.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two different fabrics that we are showcasing. There's the Kente fabric and Ankara fabric. Kente is typically the royal fabric of Ghana,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't wear Kente just to go to the park. Or,
okay.
Or to hang around at home. You wear Kente if you're going to an event that is once in a lifetime, right? It's so important that's where you kind of want to save and wear your Kente outfit to. Whereas Ankara, it's a very colorful, dynamic piece of clothing. You can wear it anywhere, to work, you mm-hmm. can wear it to hang out, you can even wear it to even big occasions. But then that one has more of a, diverse use case to it.
Yeah, it's like the difference between a tuxedo and like the clothes you wear to like to work.
There you go.
Yeah.
Such a phenomenal point.
Mm-hmm. So are you guys planning on doing other countries then too? Are there any in the works at the moment?
Absolutely. So we haven't identified the next country yet, but that is the plan. Like, literally, we want to be able to travel the world. So India, Japan, UK, US,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Hawaii. Well, Hawaii is in the US, but Hawaii has a culture.
Yeah, Hawaii is its own thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because the culture is super important,
right,
too. Poland. So the sky is the limit. But essentially, the concept is get this NFT, right? So that when you arrive, you're treated as royalty in the country. You're not coming as a tourist, right? So our tagline is don't be a tourist.
Right.
Become a royal.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want the red carpet treatment?
I know. So that's what I've been working on. So we sold out all 3,000 NFTs, but there are a few, I think about 20 or so listed on OpenSea. Mm-hmm. And we're expecting about 300 to 500 of our royals in Ghana this December.
That's awesome. Where can people find out more about the program and the NFTs themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So the website is The Royals, so THE Royals.art, A-R-T. And I'm sure we'll also share it in the show notes. So TheRoyals.art, or if individuals are kind of new to NFTs and, you know, you just want to reach out to me to inquire, you can reach me at Hans@TheInvestingTutor.com, and I'll be more than happy to kind of handhold you and help you get this, because not only are individuals collecting this digital art piece, they are collecting an invitation to Ghana. And we're thinking about this idea, Cal. Every country that we showcase and visit, even though on a year-to-year basis there's a big event and ceremony and experience that we curate, we're going to roll out this service where if you have an NFT, right? You can visit any of the countries that we showcase at any point in the future.
Oh.
So let's say you you keep your Ghana NFT and you want to go to Ghana next year for a nominal fee, maybe it's $300, maybe it's $500. We will be able to still roll out the red carpet for you there. So you don't need to think about what am I going to do? You know, who am I going to see? We're going to do everything in terms of curating that trip for you, even if we're not necessarily hosting a big event in the country,
right?
You know, that particular year. So we're rolling out that service more than likely next year, which I'm sure will transition into our next conversation if we don't have a massive recession.
Well, that actually, are you reading my notes? No, before we actually do start running down that rabbit hole, well, first of all, I want to say that sounds amazing. That project, I definitely want to go check that out. Trying to not do that while we're chatting so I can listen to you. But I really like what you're doing with the use case. Like, that is a definitive use. Like, there is real value now with that NFT besides just the, you know, whatever the intrinsic value of the subjective, you know, component, the art.
The art. Yes. And this is something where someone's like, wait, so I buy this NFT for, when we minted, it was $200. Now, because ETH is down, you know, it's probably about $100 now. So think about this, Kyle. Someone is like, I buy this NFT for $100 and I can just show up to West Africa and get and attend a royal gala, attend your beachside cocktail event, attend excursions in the country. Like, it's just mind-blowing. Not to mention, we also have plans of hosting future cocktail events anywhere in the world. And once you have this NFT, you can attend any of our cocktail events that we throw in the future. So something like this, it just makes it so simple where someone who doesn't even necessarily understand NFTs, they're like, oh yeah, this makes sense. I get it.
Right.
I mean, and this is where many individuals, you know, who are not in the space, they hear NFTs, they think of art, but no, the NFT is just a token that allows you to identify the owner of that token, right? So it encodes ownership. It puts ownership or verifies ownership, and it puts that verification on the blockchain, right? So all we're doing is we are using the NFT to verify if a person is a royal.
Yep.
And that's the power. I wanted this to be like a basic use case to help get individuals to understand how powerful this technology is, right? And how it could be used.
Well, like, just like when the internet first showed up, like, until like the people started figuring out what you could do with it, like, it kind of just sat around for a while.
Yes.
Have you been paying attention to the thing? We just saw a story about this last week. The Sims creator is now working on a project with the blockchain to create like a virtual world where NFTs, like it's being used as like a platform for the NFTs to be sold. Like the all the characters are their own like specific NFT, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I haven't heard specifically of Sims, but I've heard of so many, you know, projects and companies, right? From Disney. Mm-hmm. To Warner Brothers. I think last night I even saw that Lord of the Rings, if I'm not mistaken, they are also looking to roll out something, not to mention Reddit. I heard now Reddit is the new NFT place. Apparently there are 3 million, you know, NFT wallets or so.
Oh.
And it's booming on Reddit. I haven't had time, you know, with all of the things that I'm doing to check it out. But once we get out of this bear market, I believe that on the other side is a great opportunity for crypto. And, you know, I'm incredibly bullish on the technology, on the use cases of these assets. And I think it's obvious for anyone who still has a sense of doubt, it's obvious that we are more and more shifting towards a digital world. Mm-hmm. So it does make sense that we will have digital currency and digital assets. There's no way around it.
The real question is going to be what form those are going to take. Like, is the government going to let us adopt one that already exists, or are they going to push the digital dollar?
And that's where perhaps we can look at the internet as a use case, right?
Oh, okay.
And I guess we can go back and forth because apparently the history of the internet is that it was a US government project. This is from memory, right? I haven't really gone and done the due diligence on this, but I heard that the use case, not the use case, but the origin is that back in like the 70s or 80s, that it was something that was created in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing about Bitcoin. We don't know who created it.
Right? Yeah, yes.
And that is the beauty of this technology. So even if it's the US that created it, they're not going to let anyone know that they created it. Because the problem with a currency is if you own a currency, you have to have the power, right? So like the US, the World Reserve currency is the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So the US has to be a global superpower so that others use your currency.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Bitcoin, because it's not associated with any country, it's not, no one knows who created it. It's not the US, it's not China, it's not Japan. Well, we have no clue. So it's easier to adopt. That's the thing that many people won't realize.
Huh.
Yeah, because if a country creates a digital currency, they have to be a superpower in order for everyone to use it. Or if I should say, and I don't mean this the wrong way, but in order to force everyone else to use it.
Well, just the trade dominance. Like
exactly.
Like if you are the main exporter of all goods, then people are going to be more likely to use your currency just because it's easier.
Absolutely. And you have the might and the power militarily, financially, you just have the power. So
right.
you achieve global dominance. And yeah. So what Bitcoin does is that no one knows who created it and it's decentralized.
Let me ask you this question then. If people did know who invented it, do you think that would that be bad for it? Would that be less likely for it to be adopted if people knew the origin?
As a currency?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be. And I know, I guess we can go back and forth and say, is Bitcoin a currency? Ideally, at the baseline, we can consider it a digital asset. But the creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, wanted it to be some kind of currency, like cross-border currency, if you will, right?
Right, right.
But to directly answer your question, if we knew the founder, would it be bad? Ethereum, the number two.
Oh, yeah, good point.
We know the creator. The creator is here in the US, right?
Yeah.
He was part of the Peter Thiel. He wanted to drop out of school. He received a Thiel Fellowship kind of scholarship. I think it's 100K or so.
Mm-hmm.
And went on and built. So no, for something that is globally adopted as a quote-unquote currency, because Ethereum is more of like, the best way to describe it, I would say an operating system, right?
Yes.
A crypto operating system that allows you to build anything in crypto. So it's not trying to go out there to say, I am the global currency.
Yes.
And the same way Google, right? Apple, Microsoft, these are companies that are putting out services. So Ethereum. So for me, the way that I look at this crypto ecosystem, to simplify for most individuals, is moving forward, I would want to own half Bitcoin, half Ethereum. Mm-hmm. That's the way that I view it. And I'm not talking about taking all of your net worth and putting half in Bitcoin, half in Ethereum.
Right.
Allocation that you put towards crypto, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 10%, right? Mm-hmm. And typically 10% is the max for the average person who hasn't gone to really steady crypto. Most people will max out at 10 because above 10%, you need some kind of massive conviction.
Yes.
Whereas 5 to 10%, you don't even need to learn much because losing 5%, and I'm not saying you're going to lose it, but losing 5% of your net worth is not going to, you know, change
right.
your lifestyle in any way. Whereas someone like myself, where I'm, you know, I'm incredibly bullish, I might lean more around the 50 to 75% range with regards to, you know, net worth and investment. I kind of lost my train of thought, going around and.
Oh, no, that's all right. You mentioned Ethereum a couple times, though. I did have some questions for you regarding like your thoughts on the merge.
Oh my gosh, what a phenomenal moment. What a phenomenal moment. For those who don't understand, so Ethereum was transitioning from proof of work
yes.
to proof of stake. And Kyle, if I forget, for people who want to understand proof of work, I'll just quickly explain why that's important.
Oh, yes, go ahead, please.
So proof of work, what it does is for you to create a crypto asset, right? So the way that Bitcoin works and the way Ethereum used to work was you needed computer systems to kind of process these, to try and like solve this numeric problem to get an answer. And once you get an answer, the system will reward you in that particular crypto asset. That's how Bitcoin is created. That was the same for Ethereum. But that uses a ton of energy, right? It expends energy.
Yes.
And you remember how we had discussed the first time we recorded, why does Bitcoin have value? Well, one, you're expending energy.
Right.
So energy costs money.
Yep.
So Bitcoin should cost something, you know, just ask. And most recently, I've heard this that I wanted to offer to you, Kyle, and the listeners, is the breakthrough with Bitcoin using proof of work, right? It's no different from if you want to go and mine gold, you need to go get tractors and you need to go and dig. You need to work.
Right.
Right.
Prove to the seller that you have gold.
Thank you. You know, go put in work to get the gold. So it's the same thing, but it's from like a computer standpoint. What it does is that it forces, when you think about, and I'm not like a physicist, but if you think about this concept of energy cannot be created or destroyed. So you cannot just make energy, right?
Yes.
Energy is there. So that means there's a finite amount of energy kind of in the world. Does that make sense? Because you can't create it and you can't destroy it.
Right.
It's just there. So there's a finite quantity of energy. So that makes sense. Now, Bitcoin has been tied to something that even in the physical world is finite. It's mind-blowing. So now you've brought physical scarcity into the digital world by tying these two things. You have to do something in the physical world, like expend energy. It could be electricity. Mm-hmm. It could be anything. It just has to be energy. And then it creates a Bitcoin via a powerful computer system. So now you have something that's scarce in the real world, which is energy, right? You don't have an unlimited amount of electricity or an unlimited amount of oil. So it forces scarcity in Bitcoin as well.
Hmm.
Now, what Ethereum did is they moved away from proof of work to yes. proof of stake. And proof of stake is more like what our system is like. The people who have more of the money, the, let me not call it wealth, but
yeah,
you know,
you could say, yeah,
nerds will understand. If you have more of the money, more of the wealth, you get to call the shots. You get to, you know, make the decisions, mm-hmm. if you will. That's a simple way to put it. So what people are doing now is they are going to puts down a quantity of Ethereum. I believe it's either 32 mm-hmm. or 34. So you're going to stake your Ethereum. You're going to put the Ethereum down, each person who's kind of validating the transaction, and you all will check the incoming data and then confirm that, oh, the info coming in is accurate. So everyone checking that data together will create a consensus that, oh, yes, we have the right transactions and everything going on. If someone tried to come in to fake a transaction, the 32 ETH that they put in, they lose it. So there's no incentive to come in and try and, you know, fake transactions. That is how what it's transitioned to. As you can imagine, there's no proof of work now required. There's just people with Ethereum making the decision. So the people with the money are now making the decision. Then that doesn't cost a ton of energy. So Ethereum has reduced their energy usage by like 99.9%.
And I think we've actually seen that in the graphics cards market. Like, I haven't checked the prices recently, but it seems like since that merge was completed, or even in the start of the lead up to it, that the prices have finally started coming down on the cards that are used to mine cryptos.
Yes, I think I overheard that on an NVIDIA earnings call. And yes, absolutely.
So we're using less energy, but now if the power now shifts from the people who have computing power to the people who basically just have money, is there any danger to that, do you think?
That's what the Bitcoin crew would say, right?
Okay.
We are trying to create a new system where everyone is treated fairly. You go get your energy, you create Bitcoin, and also the holders, anyone can hold Bitcoin. You cannot reverse a Bitcoin transaction. But in the case of Ethereum, and even this has been done before in the past, if there's a massive hack on the Ethereum blockchain, and this doesn't happen often, it just happened once with, I think, a side chain or something like that. The entire, and this was very early, they paused the Ethereum chain and then reversed that transaction, right?
Wow.
Yes. So many of the individuals in crypto are saying, wait, no. Now you all have so much power, you can even do what you want. It's not that they wanted a hack, but the point of this system is no one controls it.
Right.
Either ways, I say all of that to, and I was sharing with the listeners, I'm a believer in half Bitcoin, half Ethereum. Why?
And that makes sense now.
Yes.
Like you're covering both bases in that case. You have the old system and the new system.
100%. Because we don't know if the government, specifically the US government, is going to feel threatened by Bitcoin. And I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, because what if they created it? We don't know if the US government is going to be threatened by Bitcoin. And would prefer Ethereum. Mm-hmm. But for me, both of them, because if one of them becomes the main dominant crypto asset, for just to put some context around it for people who are listening, the amount of assets held in the real world as it relates to stocks, real estate, gold, everything combined is about $400 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
To put that into context, if only 5% of that 400 trillion is to move into digital assets, just 5%, I don't even want to say 10,
right,
which to me is obvious, or even 20%, which is even more obvious. Let's say 5% moves into this crypto assets. That means we should see crypto at $20 trillion. It's currently 1 trillion.
Oh.
Yes. That means on the baseline, there's a 20x growth from here.
Huh.
Yeah, once you just start to simplify things and you look at this and you're like, oh, wow, this is not even complicated. It's so simple. And it's not as risky as the way individuals look at it, because this technology is out there. Look at what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the year, the White House put out a proposal that the different Department of Energy, or this, like all of the different government agencies were required to go and study crypto. That was the White House order, so that the US can remain an innovative financial country and possibly, they didn't make this so obvious, but possibly embrace it. That was the context, right?
I think that that order there and Powell and Yellen's inability to even classify it is one mark or check mark against the U.S. having created it.
Well, they are good at pretending. If you create it, you wouldn't want... Remember, we talked about the whole concept of currency. You wouldn't want the entire world to know, right? Because...
Yeah.
And Ray Dalio did work on this. Every, 100 or 400 years or so, there's a new global power. I think 70 to 100 years, there's a new global power.
Mm.
So if that's the case, you would want something that is not,
not tied to any specific country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, that's the way I look at this space. And on the low end, like I said, a 5% is a 20x growth. But if crypto captures just 10% of that asset or even 20%, then, we're talking 40x or 80x growth from here. And that's where it gets super exciting. For me, I think personally, right, I think it should be around 25%. That's what would make sense for me. I'm not saying 50%, mm-hmm. but 25% of 400 trillion is a lot of money. It's 100 trillion. It's 100 trillion, which is 100x from here. So yeah.
So how much of the, what's the right word? The distribution, I guess, of the assets in crypto or the allocation?
Yes.
Like you've got the big two, and then like what's the split from them to the others?
Oh my gosh. So we're looking at, and this I'm doing off the top of my head. So it's an approximate estimate.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at Bitcoin probably, somewhere around 40. Bitcoin is literally around 40 to 50%. Ethereum is around 30 to 35%. And then all of the others, which, are typically like 18,000 coins, will take up the remaining like 10 to 15%.
So that's the other reason why you want the big twos, because that's where they're like the blue chips at this point.
Absolutely. And out of all of them, Bitcoin is the only one that we don't know who created it.
Okay? Right.
And you can't, associate it with a particular country or founder or anything. It is the main kind of decentralized crypto asset.
It's the OG.
Absolutely.
Okay. Before we pivot one more time, I do want to ask you real quick about the stable coins. Have you been following the collapse of Terra?
Yes, I have.
Can you explain exactly what happened? Like, how is something that's supposed to be stable, how does it get decoupled from that like that?
Yeah, so Terra was an algorithmic stable coin. What it means is that they were trying to make it stable. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not technically stable. It's something that they dreamed of making. And the reason, and it's fascinating. If you ask them, how are you making it stable? They were like, oh, we're buying a lot of Bitcoin to keep it in our reserves, and we're going to use Bitcoin to keep it stable. Well, everyone listening to this, I'm sure, knows and understands that Bitcoin can go down.
Yes.
And it can go up exceedingly. So the founder, Do Kwon, I think he just envisioned Bitcoin just constantly going up, because if you have an asset that's just going up,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you can use it to kind of stabilize your stable coin, if you will, because you will have more money than the individuals who are trying to just say request for their money back, right? So to keep this simple, let's say you have 50,000 of a stable coin,
mm-hmm.
and you have 50,000 of Bitcoin in reserves, right? And that Bitcoin is pegged at $50,000, right? To keep it simple.
Yeah.
If 50,000 people each have put in a dollar, so there's 50,000, if everyone wanted their money back and your Bitcoin was 50K, yeah, you can pay everyone.
Right.
And the system is still in place. Well, what happens if Bitcoin drops 50%? And you have 25,000 and people thought they bought 50,000 worth because each person has a dollar. Now you're in trouble. And that's technically what happened.
So the problem isn't the theory behind stable coins. The problem is using something that's not stable to try to stabilize your product. Does that sum it up?
100%.
Okay. Oh, that makes perfect sense.
USDC, which is US dollar stablecoin, is backed by actual dollars or US government treasuries, short-term treasury. So like a three-month treasury, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is literally interchangeable for a physical dollar, right? And USDC is trying to get their coin, if you will, approved. So it becomes the main digital dollar,
mm-hmm.
right? Obviously, there's talks about the central bank, the Fed, creating a digital dollar. But can you imagine the person who creates it can track it?
Oh, yeah.
So if the Fed created a digital dollar, it can know every country that has the dollar, everyone that has the dollar. It could literally create programs to say, hey, we're going to, you know, these people, and I'm not saying that's what's happening, but hey, these individuals are not listening to what the government is saying. We're just going to turn off the
I mean, we kind of do that already, don't we, with sanctions and freezing people's assets?
Exactly. But this time I'm talking about it as in not only countries, but even within the country, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you all are not listening to us. We'll just turn off your dollar, right?
Oh, that is... That sounds scary.
It does sound scary. So that's another proponent. You cannot turn off Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter who you are, you can't turn off Bitcoin because it's not a centralized thing. So with that being said, it makes it so that USDC is more appealing
mm-hmm.
to the average person because they are not tracking who has USDC. It's just a private kind of dollar.
Right.
Which is backed by the government. So it's, in my opinion, just much better and more likely to see success. Now, here's another thing that everyone who's listening is going to really enjoy and love, especially if they are, you know, a U.S. citizen or, you know, born and raised in the U.S. or they have a permanent resident status in the U.S. It is this. The entire world we know wants dollars. Well, if you digitize the dollar is able to move at the fastest rate it's ever moved in history. Because literally, that the dollar can get everywhere in seconds. All of a sudden, you can have individuals in developing countries like where I'm from, Ghana. All of a sudden, they might keep their day-to-day expenses in local currency, but they can keep all of their lifetime savings in dollars. Because why wouldn't you want to own the most... You know, the strongest currency of all. So this allows the dollar to even proliferate many countries.
Right, right.
Right. Imagine India. I can go on and on, but you get where I'm going with this. Like, we need to, and this is why I am 100% of the mindset that we're going to see a digital dollar,
mm-hmm.
a private one, right? USDC approved. Either before was well, very close. So, you know, either this year or definitely next year. That is a must because the U.S. has everything to gain from doing that.
Sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder why what's taking so long.
Ah, you know.
That's the government.
Bureaucracy, you know, just slow moving. You know, yes.
They also have a recession they're dealing with right now, too.
I know. And trying to...
Well, wait. Actually, what's your take on that? Are we in a recession now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
Even though the White House said that that's not true.
Yeah, you don't get to cherry pick your recessions.
Okay. Okay. Well, how are you defining a recession then? Let's start with that.
Yeah, well... And that's a very good question. I'm just sticking to the old definition, which is, you know, in quote, a technical recession, which is just two quarters of negative
shrinking GDP.
GDP, yes. I'm just sticking with that because it's been kind of like the main technical indicator. But the reason that I would say that we are, I guess the better way to phrase it is we're heading towards a recession. That's even much better, honestly.
Well, looking at the history of recessions, how often are they actually identified at the start of them anyway?
Yeah, very rarely. That's true.
I don't have a whole lot of experience with that or remember as many of them, but Mike.
Yeah, it's always looking back, right? Oh, by the way, we were in a recession during this period.
Yeah, and then, but no, it's okay now. It's all good. We're out of it.
Yes. And the reason I know with, I guess, saying 100% certainty makes it seem like you're a bit, you know, like in quotes, cocky or know it all. So I'll just say 99.9%. Right, to leave that ounce of hey, you know, you could be wrong.
You can change my mind, but it's going to be hard.
Yes. And the reason I say this is because of what's currently happening, right? The Fed, right? If you listen to Jay Powell's speech at Jackson Hole over this summer, he explicitly stated that we need to bring inflation down, right? And we will get the job done and there's going to be pain.
Yep.
But the pain is what we need to keep kind of financial stability, right? Mm-hmm. So economic pain means recession, right? So the chairman of the Federal Reserve that controls our monetary policy, which means he controls the flows of credit, if you will, in our financial system, is telling you that things are going to be tight, right? And if things are tight, it means it's a recession. So that is why I believe with 100%, well, 99.9% certainty that we are.
It wouldn't fault you if you said 100%.
I know. We're headed squarely towards a recession.
This one seems different though, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, we have a really strong jobs market.
It does.
Like a lot of the inflation concerns seem like they're based on supply chain issues rather than actual like traditional inflationary pressures.
Mm. Well, I would push back a little bit. Right.
It used to. Maybe not now.
Exactly. 100%. Right. We'll say supply chain issues was definitely one of the main culprits. But let's not forget the demand side of the equation when, you know, a ton of money was pumped into the system. Mm-hmm. And this is where going back to our earlier discussion around being at a party and wondering if the inflation police is coming in to stop it.
Yep.
Right? We spoke about that analogy the last time that we spoke. Well, during the first year of the pandemic, when individuals were calling for inflation, even that summer of 2020, I was like, no, like there's not going to be inflation because the economy was shut down. So we're losing some percentage of GDP and they are just filling it. Right? So let's say there's $20 trillion of economic value that's made in the U.S., right? And now they've put in $2 trillion, which was, I think, the original package, if I'm not mistaken, which is just say 10% of GDP. So I'm like, no, there's definitely not any inflation. Like, they are bridging that gap. Well, and this is my fault, but I just got used to it. I got used to the money in the system, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I lost track. I lost track of the fact that we went on and issued two more care packages. You know, and while that's happening, the Federal Reserve increased their balance sheets by like $4.5 trillion. And on the fiscal side, there's also trillions being put in. I was listening to, I don't know if it was Larry Summers or Ray Dalio who stated that, or Peter Druckenmiller, he stated that $30 trillion or so was created. In, you know, and I was like, wait, in my calculation back then, it was just $2 trillion. If I knew $30 trillion was what was created, or if I had been staying, you know.
I think we saw some, like there was more money created that year than like in the history of money, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, I heard, was it 20 or 30% more money created than, yeah, the history, absolutely, going back.
Yeah.
So with individuals who are looking and they are seeing that, oh, $30 trillion has been created, and the reason they saw that is because they are looking at both the fiscal, which is government, they are looking at what is being created at the Federal Reserve. They're also looking at what is being permitted to be created, maybe through banking them and things of that nature. So they are adding everything up. And, you know, we were just in the thick of it. There's just money coming in, money going out. And, you know, you kind of just forget that on a year-to-year basis, there's 20 trillion in terms of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this went overboard. So clearly, all the signs were pointing to inflation coming. Back then, I wasn't a core believer that inflation was coming. Having to...
When we spoke?
It's not that I wasn't a core...
I was going to say, when we spoke, you were sounding the warning bells when we talked. I remember you were specifically mentioned home prices skyrocketing and nobody asking the question why.
When I say that inflation coming, I mean to the level that we are at.
Oh.
Right? It was shocking to look back at and say,
yeah,
how did we come to 9%, right?
Right.
And whether or not this inflation that we're seeing in 2021 when we spoke was more temporary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe being around the 5% range where it was and receding back to about 3%, or, you know, going overboard to about 9%. And that's where, looking back, I was very cautious about inflation. But looking back, I was like, I didn't foresee a 9%. And every single day now, when I look back, I was like, you know, what did you miss?
Right.
To speak. And it's a few things. The first is that, one, I was hyper-focused on the fiscal side of things, the money that was being created by the government. And it was, at that point, it was mainly what had been done in 2020, prior to our call, because I think we spoke around like February or so, right? So prior to our call.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm, it was mainly what had been done by government. So I was looking at the number that, you know, was being created by governments, not to mention there was some being created at the central banks, you know, the Fed and things of that nature. Not to mention other central banks across the world were also printing money.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So looking back, I would have been way more cautious. Would I have changed my strategy? Probably not, right? Because you all know that I'm mainly a long-term investor. So for me, it's not really trying to time the market per se. It is being able to make sure you're getting good investments that you're holding, you know, for the long term. But this, I have to hand it to you, Kyle, this would have been a fantastic market to trade. And the reason I say that is from the start of 2022, I knew that the tide had turned. So I personally didn't even buy any long-term investments, right? Because I anticipated that everything is going to be moving lower. So imagine, as a trader with this kind of, you know, I guess, knowledge and insights, I would have done really well.
if your head was good, that's the hardest part of trading. It's seeing the stuff isn't as hard as actually being able to execute with discipline.
That is so true. And you would know best, right? Because that's kind of what you do. Whereas for me, I'm looking back and I'm like, I see this happening. But to your point, many of the traders do mention that same thing, which is once you have your trading plan or trading strategy, you have to stick to it, right? You have to be disciplined.
All strategies are pretty much interchangeable. You really just have to find one that really speaks to you, that you feel and can follow. And it's all about the headspace. Like, it's all in your head. Such a tough game. You really have to understand yourself more than anything else.
You have to.
Such a weird thing, isn't it?
I guess that's the point of life also, right?
I know, right?
Yeah, it is getting deep, but you have to know and understand yourself.
I find it interesting that you like crypto so much, but you don't trade.
Yeah. So should I share with you the reason why I don't trade?
Oh, sure.
It's been tough for me this year because I just see everything that's going on. And the fact that I study, you know, global macroeconomics at such a level, I just feel like if I was a trader, right, and not trying to toot my own horn here, but I just feel like, you know, at the very least, I'll do well at the least. Mm-hmm. So my experience was, life started in Bronx, New York. And I remember I was working this day. I had worked for an entire week. It was a Friday in New York, Fordham Road. And I get out. I had just been paid $250. Back then, you know, working for minimum wage, they literally hand you your paycheck in cash.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember getting a check and having to go to the bank and cash it.
So they give me this money. I'm walking down from work and I see a group of, you know, young men, you know, kind of playing and everyone is screaming. And I go and look and it's just this game where there's this ball with cops and they roll the cops. And if you can point to where the ball is, you can double your money.
Oh, three card money kind of thing.
It wasn't even cards. It was just like, you know, the red cups.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they do. Yeah. And that was the first time actually seeing something like that, believe it or not. Right. Because I was born and raised in Ghana.
Oh, man, that's sad.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is. So I stood there for about 5 minutes just watching several people play, honestly. Mm-hmm. And man, every time I would pick the ball in the cup in my mind, it would be exactly that.
Yeah.
So after seeing that for like 5 minutes, I was like, yeah, let me go in. So I put $100 down out of the 250 I was holding. And I was thinking, oh man, easy money.
Yeah.
And I picked the first cup, it's gone. And it was gone so fast. I was like, no, this was definitely a mistake. So let me put down another 100.
Oh no.
I know.
Oh no.
And it was gone. I was left with 50. I walked away from there crying.
Yeah.
Crying. I saw $200 that I had worked for 1 week evaporate in seconds, or if I should say a minute and a half or so.
Right.
And that was the moment that I essentially was like, yeah, I'm never going to gamble. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to gamble. I'm never going to, you know, just take a huge big bet without data, without right. facts, right? So, you know, maybe I don't know whether it's to my credit or not, I kind of lumped day trading, which is very short-term trading, into that kind of bucket in my mind, right? Because, you know, back then, maybe it's different now, but back then I felt like you're guessing whether a stock is going to go up and down within a day. And how do you know what's going to happen, right? If it was maybe for a longer period, maybe weeks or months, preferably months, that I could kind of, you know, kind of understand, right?
Well, you know, markets are fractal, right? So, I mean, the patterns that play out that clue you in on a swing trade like that, like a trade that takes, you know, a few weeks to a couple months, those same patterns play out on the intraday level as well.
You see, and this is where you have the expertise, because I haven't looked at any of these things, right? But from the mindset of someone who is a novice at trading, because I haven't.
It also sounds like risk averse too.
What was that?
I would also throw out the term risk averse.
That too, right? That experience. And the thing that I do need to share is there are successful traders out there.
Oh, right?
Yeah. They are successful traders. So it's not that there isn't an art and a science around this, or that it's not being done. It is a person's particular experience leading them in a particular direction, which was mine.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the way I take it as, you know, hey, Hans, you are supposed to be the one teaching others about long-term investing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that I take my story as, right? Like I say, God doesn't want me personally, not others, but me, to be hyper focused on trading, because maybe I might do, you know, well there, and there's that lost opportunity of who is going to teach people about investing in a 401k, you know,
right,
having some allocation to index funds like the S&P 500 and getting stocks of companies that you love and understand, like the Apples, Amazons, right? And holding them for the long term. Who's going to be doing that if, let's say, I'm doing well trading? I won't be doing that. You get
right.
So I think that that experience was meant to happen, because it kept me away from, you know, trying to
riskier things.
Exactly. But you're saying riskier, but many people will consider crypto to be extremely risky, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it from a very long-term perspective. I also look at it from the standpoint that many underrepresented groups and communities missed out on some of the greatest technology. Mm-hmm. And we missed out as investors of those technologies. We didn't hold any assets, you know, with those new emerging technologies. So we didn't benefit on the upside. So my core belief is get some exposure, right? Could be 2%, 3%. It could be 1%. honestly, it could be 1%, because
20 years from now, you're going to want it.
Absolutely. With the calculation I shared with you, if it gets 5% of global assets, and that's 20 trillion, that's a 20x growth. Well, 20x means that if someone owns just 1% of Bitcoin or of crypto, right? Let's say Bitcoin and Ethereum. Well, if we get a 20x growth, that automatically reprices to being worth 20% of your portfolio without you doing anything, right? Yep. Without you doing anything, it reprices to be worth 20% of your portfolio. But if you own, let's say, 10% of it, that's where it gets really exciting, right? Because a 10x growth or a 20x growth on 10%, you know, and I don't want to do quick percentages kind of breakdown in my mind, but you can end up looking somewhere around 90, 95% or higher.
Yeah.
Probably even 99 or so percent or higher, depending on how the other stocks or equities in that portfolio performs.
Well, Hans, I'm glad that you took the path you did, because I think you're doing a phenomenal job teaching people about investing, and you're a fabulous spokesperson for the crypto and NFT community, one of our favorite guests.
Thank you. Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. I just don't want us to miss out. Honestly.
I think you'd be a fantastic trader if you ever put your mind to it. But I also understand I understand that you got to believe in it and want it too.
Like, I feel it in my heart. Like, just
that right there. You can't replace that. You can't fake that.
Mm-hmm. I feel it in my, like, this year specifically, I've really felt it. Like, man, if I was a trader, man, I just feel it. Because even around June, July, after that high that happened, right? Mm-hmm. It's fascinating how I I'll share with you how I could get a sense of that high in the market, that June high. Mm-hmm. And it's because the Federal Reserve they had this 2-month period where they weren't, you know, speaking to the public or hosting any of their meetings, their monthly meetings.
Right.
So I was like, there it goes. The market has a free range to just believe whatever they want to believe. And the market did.
Yep.
Because the Fed wasn't saying anything. So the market just went on a tear. And the point it stopped was after Jay Powell's speech at Jackson Hole.
Yeah, right.
So you, as a trader, you could literally have just, you know, who studies the market very, 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 very closely. And I'm sharing this from someone who looks at it from trying to anticipate based on, you know, macroeconomic conditions, what's going to happen. Obviously, I am 100% sure, and I see this because I watch other traders, how you can look at charts to anticipate certain movements because of probabilities of certain happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea how to read charts. So imagine combining kind of like a macro lens with maybe you're seeing something in the charts that even refines your knowledge and insights to be able to make incredible decisions. So this year, I've been really, you know, feeling the FOMO of, man, I wish I was a trader.
Well, there's some awesome resources out there. I can point you to them anytime you want to start like diving into like technical analysis or learning. Like, I think that is good for everyone to understand, whether you're going to trade with it or just be an investor, because that'll at least help you pick better entries for, you know, the investments that you do want to hold.
Yeah, and I do want to, because to your point, I think that would have even helped me in give and take 2021, because perhaps I, you know, could have gotten a sense of, let's call it, the top of the market, right?
Right.
Because I've been a mainly fundamental kind of analysis person. I don't look at charts. So that would have been so, so helpful. Something like, you know, and this might seem basic to you, but apparently like the 200-day moving average tells you a lot about long-term trend.
Good, yeah.
And,
yep.
And, you know, this past year or so is when I heard about 200-day moving average. And I'm like, what? Come on. You know, so yes, please do share the resources. I would love to begin kind of diving in.
Well, I would highly recommend TradePro Academy's fundamentals course. That is like a crash course in like institutional level technical analysis.
Excellent. I'm going to put that on my to-do list. And Kyle, if I could share this as something that I would want your listeners for the, you know, traders that are
here. People who want to understand macroeconomics.
Yes, specifically for the next trading move, which I might not be able to partake in because I don't know how long it would take me to learn all of this. what I would want to share with you is the Federal Reserve is going to have to pivot at some point. What that means is they're going to have to pause at some point with regards to kind of the quantitative tightening and the increasing of interest rates. They are going to have to pause. My estimates is that pause will come anywhere between, let's call it December of this year to let's say March or April. I'm leaning more towards first quarter of next year as when the pause is going to come, in all honesty.
Do you think they'll start reducing the rate of increases before then?
Yes.
I feel like they have to do something before the midterm elections.
And I was thinking about it. I believe the midterm election, is it? So the Fed is meeting on the 13th.
Oh, I thought it was the first week of November.
Let's see, unless I have it either. Let's definitely find out because I believe.
Yeah, I'll look it up right now while you're talking.
Okay, yes. So I know there's something happening on the 13th. I hope maybe it's the election that's happening on the 13th. But this November meeting, I just feel it's going to be 75 basis points because of the inflation prints that we had, right? Core CPI was 6.6%. Now, core CPI is really what they pay attention to because it strips out energy and food, the most volatile components of an inflation basket. So if you're looking at your core inflation heading up, it's going to be very strange for them to do like a 50 basis points hike. So more than likely, this November 75 is baked in. So if it is really, and have you discovered when it is?
It looks like the meeting is on the 1st and 2nd, but that doesn't necessarily tell you when all the information comes out.
Gotcha. Yeah, that means it's coming out on the 2nd. But the market consensus is it's going to be 75. If it's not 75, I am going to know with confidence that the Fed can be skewed politically, right? It's going to be quite clear to the market. And the market is going to rip if that's the case, like literally like Thor.
Well, I think even if they just come out and say, okay, this is the last 75 bip hike.
That is also another.
I think that's all you need.
That's also another very, very good point you bring up because then it signals without you necessarily doing much that, hey, this is the top in terms of rate hikes, and we're going to be seeing lower numbers from here. That's also a very, that's a strategic way to walk that fine line.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And I'm sure that's what's going to happen.
Well, we've already seen members speaking up about bringing up the question, and I think they've even mentioned that this meeting coming up, that's when that's going to be one of the key discussions.
Yeah.
Was when to start, slowing the pace of the hikes.
Yeah. So pay attention to that. So when that pivot starts to happen, because the market is going to begin to kind of soar, but the market is really going to soar when a pivot happens.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning, like they are going to stop and watch, right? Now this is going to be very, very important because the pivot happens, the market is going to take off. But what we need to identify is on the other side of that pivot, what happens, right? Do we get a few more rate increases because that is going to bring the market down again, or would inflation peak, meaning that we will never see a higher inflation print once the pause happens? Because if we don't, then it means everything it's just smooth sailing from there, right?
Yeah.
There's the speculation that we could see inflation pick back up, right? And that's a speculation. We don't know if it's going to happen. Or that we can see earnings reports kind of, that's when recession hits the market, where sometime, let's say summer of 2023, economy comes weak, recession hits, high unemployment, things begin to kind of just go downwards, earnings revisions. I hope we don't throw in maybe another bump in inflation, because if you combine those two, that is just a recipe for concern. But That's what I'll be keeping an eye on. That reversal by the Fed and the pivot, I would say, would be great opportunities. Not to mention, I'm sure, Kyle, you're going to add some technical things that you can be looking out for as well.
I mean, really just paying attention to market structure. I know one thing that we talked about wanting to see before we, one of the things, I don't remember if that was when we were talking with you or not, or if that was afterwards, but we have been looking for at least the COVID highs to get revisited, and we came really close this last push down, but didn't quite get there.
That's another thing that I'm looking at from a, so the way I view it is I'm looking at the COVID highs and also the COVID lows.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we have to go, because I'm not, you know, I don't look at things from a technical standpoint. I'm looking at the COVID lows as the absolute, like the worst of the worst case, of the worst case scenario. But I just want to see what that is, right? And some point in between seems kind of, you know, if things get bad, some point in between. But definitely that, you know, the high of that, which I don't have like a chart in front of me.
Yeah, it's about 340 or just shy of 340.
Gotcha.
Let's see. The low was right about 218.
Yes. To some, yes.
That's a pretty big spread.
It's a huge spread. We, you know, so in my mind, I'm like, you know, if there's some kind of combination of the two, we could see somewhere around. I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, because it depends on so many factors. And that's why you can't really predict exactly what's going to happen. But, you know, do we fall somewhere in between like that 270, 280 type range? You know,
Fortunately, it'd be impossible to tell until we actually get to those points.
Absolutely.
With technical analysis, all you're really getting is areas where you know buyers and sellers should be interested in. And then you have to wait for confirmation to see which side is going to actually win that fight.
Wow. This sounds interesting.
I think you'll be very interested. I'll make sure I get that link to you. We're starting to run a little bit long. I know you probably got other meetings for the day. For the listeners who want to learn more about you or learn more about the Investing Tutor, do you have links or resources?
Yeah.
Websites you want to share?
Absolutely. So my website, before I dive into that, just wanted to thank you, Kyle, for, you know, a great conversation.
Thank you for coming back.
Yeah, always love speaking to you and your audience. It's always fun and look forward to it always.
To make sure less time goes by next time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For those listening, my website is theinvestingtutor.com. And for Black Friday and also early next year, I'm rolling out two things, which, you know, if you don't mind, I'll check.
Oh, yeah, please.
Black Friday, what I want to do is to roll out this topic of billionaires. What are, you know, these billionaires, what have they done, or what are they preparing to do in terms of how they are allocating their money during a recession, right? So I'm going back and kind of studying, you know, these individuals to look at how have they positioned themselves to navigate this recession. So the Black Friday offer would be that. And in terms of price point, it would be about $100 for that.
Oh, ain't bad.
And next year, I am revamping all of my programs. So instead of having, you know, my programs priced at different, you know, price points, because I'm continuously learning so much that I'm creating so many new programs. So instead of doing that, I'm just going to have like a monthly subscription or a yearly subscription, right? Which will range between $30 a month or $25 a month to $50 a month. I still have to figure out what price point I settle on. So individuals have access to everything, right? Like all of the programs that I offer. So they don't have to pay a few hundred dollars here, a few hundred dollars there. They just have access.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, everything from my private tutoring programs, which are a few thousand dollars to get access to that information, because that's more in-depth kind of fundamental analysis, to the workshops or masterclasses that I host, like what I'm sharing with you, you know, this Black Friday, individuals who have access to all of that for that subscription payment. And I'll be launching that next year. So I'm pretty excited about that, because I'm more than likely going to add kind of like a weekly office hours type thing where I'm consistently sharing all of the updates that I'm getting on in markets. And also during the week, if there's something important going out, I can send out an email, right? When you have a base of kind of monthly subscribers or yearly subscribers, there's that incentive to, let me go put this out. Let me do this, let me do that. And yeah, so that's what I'm working on.
Are you going to do it as an NFT?
I should probably.
I think you should.
I should probably, yeah, roll out an NFT for this as well. That is a great idea that I didn't even think of that.
I think you would have got there.
I know. Eventually, you're right. I try to keep it simple because most individuals just mainly use like some kind of card to make their payments. So
And
I will likely do that, allow card payments, but, you know, maybe we can airdrop an NFT to our subscribers.
Oh, I love it. So the investingtutor.com, and then we also have the royals.art if people want to check those out. And if anybody wants to email Hans, we'll have his email address in the episode description as well. But that was Hans@theinvestingtutor.com.
Absolutely.
Dr. Hans?
Kyle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too, for coming back. Like I said, I'm going to get you scheduled again in the next couple months so that way I don't have to wait so long.
Yeah, I'm so curious. I'm so curious what the markets is going to look like around March, right? So please, as soon as something major happens, like what happened in the UK, maybe in the US where, you know, and for those who don't know, UK pension funds were about to go under. So the UK central bank had to step in to, you know, pump liquidity or, you know, quantitative easing into the system in the US, UK, to keep financial markets, you know, kind of chugging along.
Right.
Are we going to see some kind of a liquidity event here in the US? What's it going to do? You know, so many questions going on in my mind. So yes, let's definitely do that sometime next year and look forward to it.
All right. Thanks again, Dr. Hans. And thanks again, everybody, for listening. We'll be back at you soon with another fantastic guest episode. And we should have some trading information coming out on Wednesdays. And if you enjoyed this guest or if you'd like to check out any of our others, we've got a great catalog of past guests. Dr. Hans is on there with his previous one. If you missed that, recommend you check all those out. But fortunately, we got to close up shop and turn the mics off because Dr. Hans has a real job. We can't keep him all day, fortunately.
it's always a pleasure to speak with you all. So yeah, we'll talk soon.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. Have a good day.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.